everybody. Welcome to a new episode of Tech Can Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I'm your host, Paul David, founder and CEO of Literal Humans. And I'm joined today by Nikki Barua, co-founder and CEO at Flipwork. Welcome to the pod.
Hey, Paul. Great to be here.
Good to have you. So by way of introduction, he runs Flipwork. They're an AI transformation partner that helps organizations evolve into agentic enterprises. Nikki's a serial entrepreneur, three-time master's degree holder, and a best-selling author who spent 25 years proving that the most powerful technology on earth is still the human being. I love that. Like against the grain, with the grain, who knows these days. Nikki's been recognized by EY and Entrepreneur Magazine as one of the most influential women in business. She now leads the charge in ensuring that the AI era doesn't undervalue human potential. So very excited to dig in with you. It's a hot topic. First things first, we'd like to ask our guests to kind of set the stage. Tell us about the landscape that you're working in. Obviously, the word agentic is very hot right now. Why is this agentic enterprise sort of shift? Why is it the next frontier for, you know, global organizations and companies?
Yeah. Well, look, our world of work and life in society has always been transformed by any new technology. And we've seen that throughout civilization, right? Every single shift has led to more growth, more opportunity, but also changing the old way of life. The difference now versus previous tech revolutions was that we don't have as much time to adapt. Internet first came, we still had like almost 20, 30 years to shift our businesses and way of working to truly going online. And you could still survive that way. That's not true anymore. In the world of AI, everything is moving so fast and the speed and scale of change is frankly unnatural for most humans to adapt to. And so unlike previous technologies, this is not about just learning the technology, you're also teaching it. And so what does agentic really mean? It means you are learning how to co-evolve with AI as your teammate. That's fundamentally different from simply using a software or a tool or, you know, a mobile device or something. You know, that was still dependent on how you being the driver. Agentic is truly becoming bionic in some ways, right? It's figuring out what parts you want to keep and what parts the machine does. And when you figure it out the right way, that's what makes you exponentially capable. And that's what we call, you know, people going and becoming people squared. Instead of just being an individual, you're magnified.
People squared, I like that. That's a good tagline. So you all focus on the collaboration between people and AI to kind of unlock that agility on both sides, human agility, AI agility, I assume. Yeah. What are some of the common barriers, maybe some of their cultural, maybe their organizational, structural, that you see when leadership teams are attempting this transformation?
The most common thing across the board, and we've seen this across industries and different sized companies, is that the initial sort of instinct is to invest in the technology. So you go and like get a whole bunch of like enterprise-wide ChatGPT licenses, and then you tell everybody you got to like use AI. And if you start seeing low adoption, then you send an email saying it's mandatory. Everybody's got to use AI, right? So the idea that simply providing access to the technology is going to lead to change in behavior, that's clearly not how it's working out. And at Flipwork, we have a proprietary diagnostic that measures AI readiness. And the data that we're able to see is so revealing about what's really holding people back. It's actually not fear of AI. You know, the common misconception is people fear AI. What we found is people are actually pretty damn excited about AI. You know, they love what they can do with it. The challenge is they don't know what to unlearn. They don't know what to do differently from how they've learned to do their jobs and how they think and how they lead. All of these years, there's a conditioning that happens in your normal routine work. And until you figure out what you need to let go of and what you need to do differently, people feel stuck. And so effectively, they end up, you know, investing in all these tools is like putting revolutionary tools in completely outdated environments. And to me, it's like putting a Ferrari in a lawnmower. It's not going to go any faster. If you put like a really fast engine, but you haven't changed the environment, it's still not going to work. So that's really the biggest roadblock that companies and cultures face.
Help us understand, like, how do you help organizations kind of take that step back and understand what healthy, sustainable speed of adoption looks like? Mm-hmm. And then just, you know, understand that this is kind of a people challenge as well.
It really is a people challenge first, and which also brings up the issue of who's responsible for that in an organization. Is it the CHRO? Is it the COO? And companies are still trying to figure that out. But in the meantime, I think the people on the grassroots level, what they're struggling with is not having enough time in a day to do your job and figure out how to do this new job in a new way, right? So that's just a general challenge that people that are time starved tend to face.
Can I ask about that? Because one thing I say to the team is, look, you have to think about how you do a task differently. And I say, look, if a task is going to take you an hour, I'm okay with you spending the first 10 minutes, 15 minutes thinking about how to optimize, you know, how you do the task and then jump into it and experiment and try it. Maybe I should be a bit more, you know, directive about the guidance or give more tools and resources. Yeah. But yeah, how are you getting people to integrate that into, you know, how they move at work?
Yeah, and that's the challenge, is that in the absence of a structured program, most employees don't know how to go about it. Because you look at any corporate employee, I mean, they're stretched. They're like, I don't even have time to do my regular job. Now you're asking me to learn a whole different language, a whole new way of working. And I need to figure out how to reinvent my workflows and my tools and processes and master new technology, all of that on top of everything that's already on my plate. So when they don't have the right environment structure, they just basically don't carve out the time for it. Secondly, there's an interesting research that has come out that shows people are actually afraid that by trying something new, they might break something. So these tools are so powerful that what if I connect it to, you know, our shared drive, and then I do this thing and it accidentally like leaks all the data and something goes horribly wrong. Women are more afraid than men of breaking something. So they're less afraid to experiment. So you have to provide a safe space for that kind of experimentation. And then third, there's a rise of imposter syndrome related to AI fluency, where everybody feels like, you know, others are much further ahead than them. And that sense that they are getting left behind actually starts to get in the way of the self-belief that yes, you can, and no, you're not going to break anything. And here's how you can do this step by step. And we'll walk through that. That's effectively what the Flipwork sprint is designed to do.
Yeah, I want to get into your product in a second here. But like a question I've been having is like, Do you think imposter syndrome needs to be renamed? Like, do you see people kind of embracing these tools and leveling up, you know, and maybe like they're showing up as like these incredible designers, incredible writers and strategists, and because the tool is leveling them up? Like, is there a new class of folks they're the imposters because they've leveled up and they look more experienced or more skillful or speedier than they were before? Is that happening?
It's not so much about the tool, because that imposter syndrome's been something, a term that we've been using for decades now. And so it's not about the external environment. It's that feeling of inadequacy within you, that you don't really know why, you know, or your successes aren't the result of your talent and your hard work. It's something, you know, it's a fluke, it's luck. And so even now, this feeling that incredibly accomplished, very seasoned leaders are feeling like they are irrelevant now because their fluency is not that high. And there's some truth to that. If you really think about it, like someone who's, let's say, a C-suite executive who's got 30 years of experience and has like an absolute stellar career, but suddenly in the context of AI, they're finding themselves clueless, you know, not just from a tech standpoint, but even strategically, how to navigate this world of massive uncertainty, how to prepare young talent, all of those things. When they're finding themselves sort of at odds with that, there is a reason to really question, do I have it in me? And it's, you know, one article that really caught my attention was, I think it came out about a month ago, where there was several CEO departures that they said one of the reasons was because, you know, AI disruption, that they didn't feel they were the right people to lead during that era, that they didn't have the energy and the, you know, time span to lead that, and they wanted, you know, a new generation to lead it.
Yeah, that's super interesting. Very accountable of them too to step down if that's indeed true. You don't always see that. Let's dive into your product and you know, you're building an OS for human AI collaboration. You know, there's some things that are just, you know, irreplaceable, like, about humans, right? And so I'm curious, because I saw this in action the other day. I was interviewing a candidate, and we gave them a simulation, and the prompt was to just talk to one of our clients who was frustrated and calm them down and give them a roadmap for fixing a problem. And the candidate immediately went to ChatGPT to craft her response to this, who was role-playing the frustrated client. I was like blown away. I was like, man, like, please just be a human. Like, just talk to me, because I'm already frustrated. And if you read me a script from ChatGPT, I'm going to get more frustrated. So it was a moment of learning. I ended up hiring this person. But like, how does the Flipwork methodology specifically protect those uniquely human capabilities?
Yeah. So our experience is designed on three core elements. Number one, we start with a diagnostic that really helps us understand what are the blockers for an individual, but also what makes them unique and stand out. So imagine a company with over 100,000 employees. For a leader at the top to know specifically where each individual employee is in that company, that's a goldmine to be able to figure that out in the context of AI readiness. It also measures their environmental factors, like is their manager supportive? You know, is the process that they're working with outdated, or is it the right environment for progress? So getting that foundational diagnostic is the starting point of where we start the transformation journey. From there, our AI, we have an AI change agent. Think of it like a co-pilot, like companion, coach, whatever you want to call it. And Flippy is, you know, the companion that works with every individual, but it's trained in their diagnostic and it's trained in our proprietary curriculum and transformation method, which is a combination of neuroscience and change management methods and so forth. But because it knows you, so it'll know, hey, Paul, this is your archetype, this is your score, these are some of your unique blockers. But now I'm going to guide you through this step-by-step transformation process over the next several weeks. And every week we'll work through one specific area, we'll activate some specific strategies. So it takes them through this process where they're not just learning new things, but they're also identifying what they need to shed and unlearn. And it creates the safe space for them to experiment with building agents and implementing new tools and things like that, that they might have never done before. And they start to see the shift. And so like the third element is sort of like taking this capstone project approach where they're actually building things and they start to see just the leverage that they're able to get, the hour saved, the productivity gained, or the innovation of new ideas and things like that. And so within just a 12-week period, they go through this massive change. And by the end of 12 weeks, we see, you know, pretty much, you know, close to like a 90%, you know, ranking on the diagnostic. So we're consistently seeing that kind of growth. And really the magic of it is just having that space and a trusted coach that's guiding you and giving you the exact steps to do. So you go from like just being, you know, an average worker to a truly agentic leader. The Flip framework, that's a very specific, you know, transformation framework that we've developed that the entire focus is on helping the individual figure out their unique zone of genius that is irreplaceable, that AI, no matter how advanced it gets, it'll never replace that special thing. So you gave the example of this interview scenario, you know, like, are you someone who's gifted in relational skills? Are you someone who's incredibly creative? Are you someone who has terrific judgment and, or like you have the empathy that makes you a great leader? All of those things, being able to identify that and figure out where in your workflow do you protect that and which parts can you let go. What's repeatedly come to the surface in doing this work is people are so surprised of how much AI could do that it never occurred to them. They're not surprised about holding on to their uniquely human parts. I think that's a given. They actually want to protect that. What surprises them is how much they can let go. You don't know what you don't know because you've never tried it. And we just had this happen just this week where, you know, the founder of a company basically like discovered a way that the team could handle something that was taking them on average about 6 hours per person per week to support clients, which can now be done in under 5 minutes, a very complex product. And all these years, it was something she never thought could be done by anyone but her because it was so complex. And when it was done, not only faster, but actually better, I mean, that's the kind of unlock that happens. But it's not going to happen by reading a book. You have to roll up your sleeves and do it.
I've seen that too. Like we were able to cut the time for writing briefs for content, you know, in half. And, you know, it's really interesting when you start to unlock those, you know, those advantages. You gave a couple of examples. What were some of the cool milestones you've seen companies reach as they work with your tool?
Yeah. So in most cases, when it comes to enterprise transformation, the most typical challenge that companies come with us is that they've invested in the tools and they're dealing with low adoption and they can't figure out how to get their people there. So that often tends to be the first area. And we see within 90 days, companies going at 85% plus adoption in that short time. Because really, it was never about the tool. It was simply people not knowing what to do differently. And as soon as they figure out in tangible ways what any individual can do differently, they figure it out and they drive that adoption. In terms of, you know, capacity released, on average, it's been 30 to 40% of capacity released. So let's say you have a team of 100 people, suddenly 40% of their capacity is released. The most strategic question you can ask yourself is, how do we reallocate that time? Do we want to use it for building new products? Do we want to serve customers, take on more market share? It gives you an opportunity to do something that you previously couldn't do without adding more headcount. So at an enterprise level, those are some of the most common outcomes. At an individual level, it's fascinating to see not just like their creativity and confidence grow with, you know, becoming agentic, but the level of innovation that gets unlocked, that's the part that's fascinated me. Like, you can't really measure, like, what is the innovation index, but it's fascinating to see that over and over again, that's the through line of individuals unlocked where they're coming up with new ideas. And now they have the time and the capacity and the tools to take that idea to execution.
We'd be remiss not to ask this as a growth consultancy. Obviously, like, the AI space is incredibly crowded right now, and you know, the market seems obsessed with speed and automation at this current moment. How are you scaling the human first AI strategy in a market that is, you know, kind of overly focused, arguably, on speed and automation? How are you differentiating yourself from, you know, traditional tech consultancies that are also pivoting?
One, we're not really a consulting company, nor are we like a training company. And in some ways, it's sort of like this interesting hybrid of where we found our sweet spot is developing agentic leaders. So, if you think about any of the certification firms like Assurm or Procy or the companies that like provide the skill set and the grounding to certify people of a level of skill. So that's where we are really like developing a lot of sort of unique positioning around there. And because of that, we've also taken more of the lens of towards academic partnerships, which gives us sort of the grounding and the prestige of university collaborations, but also the depth and the scientific rigor behind it. So ours has been very much focused on sort of going very top down to the boards and C-suite of, you know, particularly through private equity firms going into their entire portfolio, but also from the individual leadership level of certifying them to be agentic leaders that then like drive the growth within their firms.
You mentioned certifications. I'm curious about that. Are you actually, is there like a sort of professional standard that has arisen now out of this?
Yeah, well, that's what does not exist, right? If you really think about it, the number of firms that are popping up that previously may have never done anything in transformation and certainly didn't have depth in AI, but just label themselves that, or, you know, a variety of, like, you can open up Instagram and there's so many different like AI training, you know, programs that are available. And there's no real standard for figuring out which ones are, you know, legitimate, which ones are just, you know, ChatGPT videos and a wrapper. What is actually the standard of what defines true agentic leadership? And so we've put, you know, our stake in the ground for that. And we know we have very exacting standards and a diagnostic that is vetted by universities and really setting the bar pretty high for what that looks like.
What does the growth roadmap for Flipwork look like going forward? How are you being received in funding circles? Sounds like you're working with private equity and VCs already. Mm-hmm. Let me just understand like how you're thinking about growth 2026 and beyond.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're a pretty new company. So at this stage, our most important criteria right now is ensuring that our product is loved by the users and, you know, that we are delivering predictable results over and over again to a portfolio of big name clients. So the focus right now, we're not focused on like the scaling part yet because it's too early for that. Right now, it's more about like, how do we get this in the hands of more people that absolutely love it? And we're doing great with that. So the future stage past this stage is really going to be about like, what does it look like to create a new kind of model, which is not about just adding headcount in the company and having more consultants or trainers and all of that. But we're looking at it as a, you know, a franchise model that can like expand worldwide and still bring the local context and being industry specific for the right regions for that. So that's the kind of business model we're looking at. You know, I've previously been a founder of companies where I've like grown the headcount significantly. And I still feel like, yes, there's a path to that, but there's also new ways to build this. And I'm excited about exploring that.
That's really cool. Yeah, I mean, like the name of the game these days is like go lean and you know, see how much you can scale, especially with AI.
That's been one of the most eye-opening experiences for me. Like, you know, this is my fourth business and it is completely different from the way I've built every single part of this from my first one. It's completely night and day, and it's just blowing my mind what's possible today that was impossible 20 years ago.
Yeah, it's wild. And I feel like I'm running a different company than I was like even 6 months.
I think that's something incredible about building an AI native company, because you're designing agility into the DNA of the firm. And every single aspect is automatically designed for scale and agency. And I think that's why the culture of the firm matters so much in terms of having high agency people. But when you combine high agency people with that kind of operating agility and you know, scale, you think about growth very, very differently. And that's why, like, even your question about like investors and things like that, you know, I see us as already, you know, different in terms of our capital requirements, that it changes your equation in terms of, you know, do you really need that? Is there a different way to fund this? Which might have not been possible just a few years ago, where without capital, you were stuck. You couldn't grow.
You see funders racing to invest in AI, but also like there's a huge, you know, downward pressure on the need for those funders and investors in many ways. Maybe there's a connection.
Like, without capital, there's no way we would have gotten to where we are today at this specific point in time. We've accomplished, had we not had significant capital, there's no way we could have done it if this was a business built 5 or 8 years ago. But today, the fact that we absolutely had no need for it is kind of revealing about the opportunity available to everyone. I see a huge rise of entrepreneurial opportunity for anyone with a great idea who wants to serve the community. They can actually do it today.
So you serve elite executives, you know, from leading brands. What is one question that they're asking you behind closed doors about the future of the workforce, future of AI? Where are their heads at?
Common question. Well, I'd say I'm seeing two different profiles. The ones that are super excited about the future and all of this want to know, you know, where to place their bets and, you know, how they can move faster and ahead of the market, because they see it as a land grab. It's like this, you know, it's like the gold rush, and they want to be first and they want to figure out how to exactly where to invest and make their bets. I'm seeing a completely opposite reaction to that. And that's probably a vast majority of leaders, where it's waiting for certainty. It's saying, oh, we're doing a set of things and we'll wait until the dust settles, and then we'll figure out the right strategic moves to make. And there's caution and there's a level of inertia there. And it's playing defense of like, what do we need to do so we don't lose? So I see that as a completely different attitude from what do we need to do so that we do win versus what do we need to do so that we don't lose. And it's interesting that it's been on two opposite sides of the spectrum.
Do those ever exist within the same organization or leadership team, or is it always one or the other?
I've seen it at least on two occasions, yes.
The agency space has been rocked, obviously, by and marketing in general, which I'm sort of grateful for in a way, but also it's been tough. But in one sense, we're sort of defending against now going up against like a junior designer with Midjourney, you know, who can totally just turn out. But also it's like, okay, how do we now build an agentic, you know, growth consultancy, an agency that, you know, sort of can scale? So it's interesting to focus on the positive, but also play a little bit of defense as well.
In the case for almost every firm, right? Like, because on one hand, you have a superpower that you can access now, but the reality is everybody else has the same superpower too. So the question is, how are you leveraging it differently? What's unique that you're bringing to the market that allows you to solve this problem differently? So it's been interesting to kind of see just how the pressure is forcing companies to really change their business strategy, their business models, and redefine a new kind of moat, because traditional moats are eroding pretty fast and you can't just hold on to those. And one of the most common areas is pricing pressure. You look at law firms, you look at marketing agencies, you look at accounting firms, it's very hard to hold on to that same pricing model and justify it when even your clients know, well, you're using, you know, ChatGPT to solve a lot of these things. I'm curious, from your perspective in the agency space, what are you hearing the most from clients?
Specific to AI?
Yeah.
I mean, I think they are curious about sort of the gains that can be achieved, both if they're using it and if we're using it. So I think, but it's shifted. Like, I think last year it was sort of like, how much AI are you using, you know, and produce all this content, you get, you know, it's sort of get in the sandbox with us and we're all working in Claude Code and Perplexity together for a lot of our more forward-thinking clients. And then for others, it's just kind of business as usual. You talk about building your own table as a leader and a human. Tell us about like your journey. Like, you know, how have your experiences kind of shaped, you know, you mentioned feeling like you're in rooms that were not built for you. What were some of those moments along the way? You're like, oh, I've arrived, but also imposter syndrome. Like, have I, and how have you shown up to this moment?
Yeah. Well, someone told me once that I'm like the poster child of diversity because I check so many boxes, you know, as an immigrant, minority, female, gay, like all of, and I was like short, you know, I can keep adding to those boxes. But regardless of what labels the world puts on you, the point is, you know, you have to be driven by what your vision is and what your dreams are. And for me, that's always been the most defining factor. From a very young age, I had like really big dreams and I was intrinsically motivated to pursue them. But I often found myself on the outside of every inner circle. No matter what space I was in, I was just, there's some parts of your intersectionality that make you connect, but then for the most part, you're on the outside. And at first, I looked at that as a roadblock to my success, that because I don't have access to those rooms, because I'm not accepted in those circles, that I, you know, it's going to hinder my success. What I actually learned over time is what makes you different is what makes you powerful. And when you embrace that and you learn to operate authentically from, you know, what your uniqueness is, it actually brings people to you. You become the magnet. Instead of chasing another circle, you become the magnet and you find people that align with your views, with your values, and are on the same mission as you. And that gives you the kind of confidence and the kind of influence that no amount of fitting in will ever do. And so that's why I'm such a huge believer that no matter what new space I get into, I just see it as like, what's my unique taste? What's my unique view in that? And I'm just going to lead with that.
Love that. And it's always surprised me how long it takes. I'm moving, just turned 40. So where can folks find out more about the great work you're doing at Flipwork? Where can they get involved?
Well, I'll share two resources that'll be helpful to anyone listening. Number one, go get your free diagnostic at, you know, flipwork.ai. You know, that's a great place to start to figure out your AI readiness and, you know, get a 15-page report on exactly where you are and what you need to do. I also publish a weekly newsletter called Reinvention Roadmap that provides actionable strategies to become agentic and lead in this AI era. And that's available at nikkibarua.com. So I share those two resources. And biggest advice is don't be a bystander. Step into the arena. The world is changing in front of us and it's an exciting time to build the future, but you can do it if you're just watching from the sidelines.
Listen, I think you've done an incredible job, you know, building your own table, as you say, and now you're helping global enterprises reinvent themselves. And you've got this amazing masterclass in resilience and vision. While AI is a tool, human potential is the engine. And I love the interplay that you have with Flipwork there. Just want to thank you so much for coming on this. Please leave a review if you've enjoyed the episode. It really helps us bring amazing guests like Nikki Barua, co-founder and CEO of Flipwork, onto the pod. Thanks, Nikki. Thanks, everybody. We'll be right back.